So let's quickly go through the criticisms. I think the way for us to proceed is I will just mention the critical point, and then we'll open it up for discussion, and then move on to the next. There are four kind of critical issues: the theory of the crisis and criticisms of the theory of crisis intensification, the theory of proletarianization, the theory of class capacity, and the theory of ruptural transformation. So first, the theory of crisis intensification. From the point of view of actually being able to predict capitalism's future, this is really pretty fundamental. And there are a bunch of reasons why I think one should be skeptical of this self-destruction thesis about capitalism. Now, one just preliminary note, to be skeptical of the self-destruction thesis of capitalism is not to say that capitalism doesn't perpetually generate huge harms. This is not a retreat from the diagnosis and critique of capitalism as a terribly damaging social order, and one in which the gap between the way things are and the way they could be is ever increasing. It's simply to say that it doesn't destroy its own conditions of existence. So it's in some sense, might seem like a small point. The main criticisms of capitalism is not that it destroys itself. The main criticism of capitalism is it destroys people, not that it destroys itself. So first of all, let me just give you quick reasons why to be skeptical of the self-destruction thesis. While capitalism does produce crises and economic disruptions, Marx, and I think most subsequent Marxists, underestimated the extent to which state interventions can significantly moderate these tendencies. Even this last financial crisis, which was huge, you know, really major crisis, it was managed pretty effectively. You know, the amount of resistance and upheaval around it has been pretty minimal. The 90% of the labor force remained employed. They became very insecure and therefore maybe were even more hesitant about resistance, but they remained employed. Conditions can be bad, but still the system is very robust and state intervention plays a key role. Now, unless there's reasons to believe that while this has been true for the last 70 years or so, 80 years or so, that the capacity of the state to contain crises, not to solve them, but to contain them to the point that they don't make the system unreproducible, unless there's reason to believe that that capacity is going to disappear, that's a reason for skepticism about the intensification of crisis thesis. Secondly, while the rate of profit in developed capitalist countries appears to be lower than in rapidly developing countries, there does seem to be a variety of pretty clear indicators that the average rate of profit once you're a well-developed country is lower than the average rate of profit in a rapidly developing country. There doesn't seem to be any long-term tendency for the rate of profit to continue to decline once a country is a mature capitalist country. It goes up and down, but it doesn't have any long-term secular trend. And finally, third reason for skepticism on more theoretical grounds, the theoretical foundations of the law of the falling rate of profit that Marx elaborated in Capital, those theoretical foundations turn out to be, I think, flawed. It is for a whole variety of reasons. The simplest is the claim that capitalism becomes ever more capital intensive turns out not to be true. Capitalism is less capital intensive today than it was 40 years ago. Because capital gets much cheaper. A computer today costs a tiny fraction of what a computer cost 25 years ago. It's just you know, capital is not, the capital intensity of production goes down. The clearest example of the decline in capital intensity is in public, is in publishing. You know, it used to take hugely expensive presses to be able to produce a book. Now, a small enterprise can produce very nice books, and electronic books can be produced at almost no cost at all. So the capital costs of producing certain kinds of products have gone way down. And thus the capital intensity, the ratio between labor and capital costs in certain lines of production have gone less. And that's because the production of capital itself gets cheaper. Capitalist innovations, when it was a question of replacing tools by machines, meant ever-increasing capital intensity. Once you replace machines with new machines, and the new machines may be way cheaper, that is, embody less labor than the old machines. And so there's no longer any reason to believe that capital intensity has any tendency to perpetually increase. Competition still puts pressure on firms to innovate, but the pressure does not have the same kind of bias towards increasing capital intensity that it had in the 19th century. So taking all those things together, capitalism may be undesirable, and its undesirableness may increase over time, but this does not mean that its reproducibility decreases over time. Okay, that's the intensification of crisis thesis. Issues, questions, I'm sure you have thoughts. Yeah, Lauren.
How about ecological crisis? Could that compromise?
Well, it could. You know, that's Marx did not entertain the idea that the Achilles heel of capitalism was that it destroys the natural environment in ways that would make it unsustainable. It's not at all clear, though, that ecological crisis actually makes capitalism unsustainable. It may make, you know, I mean, capitalism by definition is unsustainable if human life is unsustainable, but I think a pretty good case can be made that global warming could be good for capitalism, just like wars are good for capitalism. You know, global warming, what is global warming going to trigger? We're going to need, global warming may signal the end of neoliberalism, but not of capitalism. So Hurricane Sandy devastates Manhattan. The response is we need to build seawalls. The Dutch have learned how to live below sea level quite successfully. The Netherlands has a 100-year project, engineering project already on the, you know, in the design phase to raise their seawalls by 20 meters or whatever it'll take. They already know how to live below sea level. So the seawalls have to be made higher. I mean, once you know have the technology of being able to do it, they have this plan to do it. The big problem apparently in the Netherlands with seawalls and the rising sea levels is that the Rhine River is going to back up. And the Rhine River backing up will mean that the Netherlands will be flooded not from the North Sea, but flooded from behind as the Rhine backs up. And the solution, I mean, this is their real design, in engineering designs for this. The solution for the backing up of the Rhine River is pretty extraordinary. It's to dam the river and then create viaducts that will have the river flow over the dam. So big tunnels that will basically have the river flow into the North Sea over a dam so that the river won't back up behind it. In any case, so you're going to build seawalls along the East Coast. Somebody's got to build it. Now, the market isn't going to provide it, but subcontracting to capitalist firms to build seawalls, you're going to have a huge expansion of public goods to deal with climate change. Those public goods means the end of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism cannot sustain the level of taxation needed to fund the provision of massive seawalls and other climate mitigation adaptation devices. So it'll be a state-administered capitalism, the way in which capitalism was state-administered during World War II, for example, but still capitalist. Well, I don't see why the ecological crisis would necessarily make capitalism unsustainable for those kinds of reasons. Yeah.
So this is kind of a weird question, but in a way, if you're really going to take this like Marxist agenda and think it can potentially play out as these things suggest it might, would it have potentially been better if the state had not intervened with the crises and everything just become a total disaster?
Well, this is a very old theme among Marxists. Do things have to get better before they get worse? Do we want to intensify the crises? So imagine what the politics would be like. A working class party is mobilizing to prevent the state from creating a social safety net and telling the workers, I know this is going to make life tough for you, but we got to make things worse before they get better. And another party is saying, we're all for the safety net. We want to make life as good as possible under capitalism. Which of these two parties is going to attract working class support, right? So it's possible that if Franklin Roosevelt had lost, well, the most likely thing that would have happened if Franklin Roosevelt had lost the New Deal is that the election in 1932, that the Republicans would have behaved more or less like, you know, a less progressive version. It would have been more, would have been less, wouldn't have been as friendly towards workers, but they still would have engaged in new institution building. It would be my guess. So, no, I don't think the evidence suggests that intensification of crisis really opens up the possibilities of a more democratic and egalitarian ruptural possibility. This is partially what we'll be discussing on Sunday morning, because on Sunday the general issue as to whether or not the best prospects for transcending capitalism come from pushing capitalism to its most humane and egalitarian limits by building both the public goods that capitalism can provide and building alternatives within capitalism. Whether that's the best point to reach to imagine going beyond capitalism, or having capitalism be as bad as possible is the best possible way. And it is a debate, but I myself think that making capitalism as humane as possible actually makes its limits clearer to people than making it as bad as possible. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to sort of fight back on the idea of capitalism being able to survive the ecological crisis and even perhaps benefit from it. I think it might be true that like individual capitalists who are a part of like building the dams and things like that might benefit from it, but capitalism is so expansive that all of the different markets that aren't involved in specifically benefiting from the ecological crisis might still be impacted to the point where it would cause major harm to capitalism. And then secondly, the comparison between war and the ecological crisis, like at least war ends at some point, but the ecological crisis is going to continue forever if we allow it to. So I mean, just
so. The fact that it continues forever, though, is an advantage in this respect. The end of war is what led to the dismantling of the Keynesian interventionist affirmative state that maintained full employment. So during war, we had full employment. In the absence of a commitment towards the state involvement in economic activity, we have problems of unemployment. So a state-administered capitalism, or what's sometimes called organized capitalism, of the sort that did continue after World War II in significant parts of Europe, but was retrenched in the United States, it will have its own contradictions, its own crises, and so on, but there's no reason why that equilibrium can't, I think, continue in at least an indefinite way. I don't mean there could be other sources of its crisis. But the question about whether, I mean, I just don't see where the ecological crisis, so lots of people will suffer under it. There's no question about that. But why does that make the ability to get a return on investments impossible for most capitalists? There'll be all these new sources of investment opportunities, all these contracts for huge climate mitigation projects, which will include more than, I use seawalls as an example, but there's lots of other things that this will involve. Those are all investment opportunities. And if it continues indefinitely, the investment opportunities continue. It's basically just expanding a market for capital, even if it's a state-administered market. So it's true that it won't be neoliberal capitalism. It won't be the kind of capitalism we've observed for the last 30 years, one where the state continually pulls back from the direct organization of productive activities. This will be a state-administered capitalism. But then there's all sorts of second-order effects from that. The workers who are working for these, Lockheed Martin will be building seawalls. Well, those workers are going to get paid, and then they're going to go into now protected Manhattan and buy food in capitalist restaurants and buy clothes from capitalist Macy's. So I don't see why, just don't see what the reason why that isn't a, it's not that it's wonderful or greatly stable, but why it isn't viable. You had your hand up, and then.
Well, yours is probably more because you're still.
Yes. Yeah. So, but like, wouldn't it change? Like, wouldn't it alter like consumerism? Because a lot of the focus is going to be on like investment in the environment and like building seawalls, whatever that kind of stuff. Like that's where a lot of the capital is, and then that means that a lot of like current capital things would die out. Right? There would be things that wouldn't be sustainable anymore.
So this would unquestionably, there'd be a big sectoral change in the mix of what gets produced, no question.
Yeah.
Partially it's going to be a shift from private consumption to public goods. The shift from private consumption to public goods opens a space, new spaces for struggle over the nature of those public goods, because public goods always are more politicized than private consumption. But if the public goods are themselves actually being provided by capitalist firms, so some public goods are not. A national park is a public good. It's provided by a public service. But other public goods, like highways, are public goods. Everybody uses them, but they're built by private firms. And so they are a source of private investment, private returns, but in a more administered way than just ordinary competition. It would end up being a very different kind of capitalism. Now, on consumerism, it's true that if the ecological crisis is really taken seriously, then there has to be a whole reorganization of private consumption as well. I don't think it will be taken. I don't think in capitalism it will be taken that seriously. It will be all adaptation rather than primarily around how can we massively reorient our lifestyles and consumption patterns. That's a harder task for capitalism to accommodate. Yeah.
It seems like that would intensify the ecological crisis more than if it didn't adapt to it very well. And it seems like a lot of like the major industries that we have right now, like oil, wouldn't be able to exist under the kind of capitalism that you're explaining. And I think there would be a huge crisis if the oil industry, for instance, collapsed.
The oil industry is already diversifying in all sorts of ways in anticipation of transition problems. First of all, a lot of what the oil industry does is petrochemicals, not just fossil fuels, and that will continue. The petrochemical side, the producing of plastics and other things that you use fossil fuels for, you just don't burn. It's the burning of fossil fuels that will be reduced or perhaps eliminated. And there'll be disruptions, but these are huge pools of capital that will get reallocated to new purposes. You know, some giant industries at some points in time disappeared completely without it, meaning that capitalism itself as a system wasn't sustainable. Yeah, and then, yeah.
So, I mean, this is pretty speculative and I actually don't really believe it, but can we imagine that it's going to make it harder, like it's going to maybe make more impossible in the transition? Because if, you know, we are destroying our natural resources and, you know, using them in ways that we can't use them anymore, you know, like burning fossil fuels and then they're not there to make petrochemicals, doesn't that make it like harder to get, you know, sustain the egalitarian state, you know, because you can't get to whatever transition for, I mean, thesis for, because we can't have egalitarianism because, you know, there's not enough for something. I mean, it's a stretch, but if they keep using this and keep not mitigating.
So Marx believed that a condition for certainly communism and probably socialism was what he called superabundance. That basically scarcity was solved by capitalism, and then all of the inequalities were artificial impositions on a world in which people didn't have to live that way. I think we're so far above the threshold of, we're actually in the developed part of the world, we're certainly in a world of superabundance, in which the scarcities are artificial. They're the result of inequalities and the use of our resources. And consumerism as a particular way of thinking about how you relate to the material world, rather than of our lack of productivity. So I don't think that the transition out of capitalism would necessarily be coming.
Right, just because we have so much right now.
We can pull, you know, standards of living in the United States could be half of what they are now if it was reorganized in a very different way, you know, where we had free public transportation and collective facilities for recreation rather than backyard swimming pools, you know, all sorts of things that are part of the lifestyles of parts of the population, which of course absorb huge amounts of resources, but not in a way that enhances human flourishing. So I don't think we're under those kinds of material constraints, where now we're in such an austere part of world of scarcity that the pressures for inegalitarian solutions because people want to have more intrinsically rather than just because it's culturally inscribed would subvert it.
I just wanted to quickly ask what could make the ecological crisis increase the unsustainability of capitalism is all these public goods and the increasing cost of natural resources is kind of like a substitute for the increasing organic composition of capital that would lower the rate of profit.
But they make profits in the production of the public goods. The public goods are being contracted and are sold. So it's a controlled market. You get bids and you build the seawalls, so you sell, in effect you're selling seawalls to the government. The government is a collective purchaser, it's a collective consumer, and you make profits off of it. Because I just don't see any reason why public goods are, it's an important idea here, because the thing is, once you shift from private consumption to public consumption as a way to keep capitalism going, that immediately raises social justice issues in a way that private consumption doesn't, because it's all politicized. There'll be issues about where you're going to build the seawalls, just to protect the rich in Manhattan or to protect everybody. There's all sorts of issues around justice and inequality get raised once you have a large public goods sector. And so I think that and that's why I think it's neoliberalism has, the era of neoliberalism is probably nearing an end, in spite of the fact it seems so vigorous at the moment. Because I just don't think I don't think neoliberalism is sustainable in the face of ecological pressures. But the aftermath of neoliberalism can either be a very inegalitarian and authoritarian form of state-organized capitalist reproduction, or it could be a much more egalitarian and social justice oriented one. You know, so that's that seems to me open, and that's where there's a space for struggle for a more invigorated sense of alternatives. Other questions around this? Okay, let's just quickly do some of the other. The theory of proletarianization. This is, this, I think, the second major problem with the classical theory. It's certainly true that in the course of capitalist development, until you know the last decade, couple of decades, there was a pretty steady proletarianization process. And if you take it at a global level, that's continued. There are more workers in the world today than at any point in human history. That is, more people earn their living by getting a wage from an employer now than at any time, from a capitalist employer, than at any time in human history. So there is a proletarianization process that's gone on. However, it has not been a process of increasing homogenization. It's been a process of increasing complexification of the class structure. That's the arguments that I raised when we were discussing class structure, about the nature of contradictory class locations, about the complexities of families as they intersect, you know, mediated class locations, and the biographical complexity of people's relationship to class structures. So class structures have not become simpler. They have not become more polarized, even though the income inequality has become increased in the United States. It is not the case that class structures have become simplified, where you have a homogeneous mass of people facing the same conditions of life, the same insecurities, the same prospects, and the same working conditions, polarized with an elite that's also facing the same conditions. It's way more complicated, complex than that. And that means that the proletarianization process does not produce a homogenization of interests needed for that dynamic intensification of anti-capitalism. There was a hand up here somewhere. Somebody raised their hand over here. No? I thought I saw it definitely. Maddie, didn't you raise your hand?
I mean, I kind of have something to say, but I didn't really raise my hand. But now that it comes to me, I guess I do. When you were talking about it earlier, I thought about like how digitalization, you know, like how like current technology and how like a lot of people can do some like wage work from home just because they like, you know, can use computers or like program or whatever, and it doesn't require like people to be interacting in a workspace
right.
as much, and just like generally the reduction of interaction in most fields of work. How is that going to contribute?
So that's part of the classical argument, was bringing people together in large centers of work with an interdependent division of labor and homogeneous conditions of life. That's the sort of proletarianization and class capacity argument taken together. And the increasing dispersal of work, the average workplace is smaller now than it was 50 years ago. It's not the case that workers are brought together in physical proximity into large concentrations. Although the classic large factory has been reproduced, Foxconn in China, you know, notorious 10,000 workers in one place. It's a huge industrial complex. But nevertheless, overall, there's more fragmentation, more dispersion. But that prospect, that situation also brings another aspect of the most recent process, which is a process of deproletarianization. It's easier now than it was 35, 40 years ago for people to be autonomous, self-employed producers. Sometimes this is disguised proletarianization, but not always. There's a lot of, you know, self-employment, people engaged in freelance work, in which freelancers form cooperatives. So the prospects of people forming worker cooperatives are greater now than in the past. It's easier to do than it was, again, 50 years ago. partially because of the digitalization, information technologies, makes coordination and makes all sorts of things easier, but also because of declining capital intensity. Now, this is something that's, you know, pretty interesting. The 21st century is going to be, I think, a century of declining capital intensity, and particularly declining what's called a decline in the increasing returns to scale. So the question is this. I mean, here's the fantasy. I say fantasy because this is just the potential that people are projecting. Let 3D printers make it possible to produce pretty complex industrial products on a very small scale where the per unit cost is not that different from doing it in a big factory, right? So if you have a 3D printer and you can make all sorts of goods and then that are easy to assemble, one of the ideas then is you could have community-based fabrication laboratories where an array of numerically controlled machines and 3D printers were available, and worker co-ops could lease these they'd be provided as a public good. Worker co-ops could lease them, and they could produce for the market at roughly the same cost as mass producers, but without the transportation costs, you know, all sorts of other economies. Well, if this is roughly the way things are going, or could go, that means that the barriers to entry for cooperatives become way lower than they were in the past. And that opens up more space for alternatives rather than less space. Yeah?
So have you run into the arguments that some like critical librarian scholars are making about group peasantization, that even though proportionately there are, you know, very low percentage of peasants or small-scale farmers in the world today, numerically there are a lot, and that there are people that, because they can't be absorbed in urban environments, that they're choosing to, you know, keep their autonomy and be some sort of peasant, even though it's qualitatively different than
Well, and there's also, and also in the developed world, the new urban agriculture is partially people don't usually describe that as re-peasantization, but it's certainly efforts at transforming the relationship between urban and rural and creating new spaces for agricultural production inside of cities, not just in the countryside, in which agricultural production can be organized on a new basis. So in Chicago and Detroit, Milwaukee, there's efforts at creating more egalitarian, participatory, community-based urban agriculture, which isn't, again, really re-peasantization. It's not the same phenomenon as in Mexico or in other developing contexts. But yeah, I think, and technological changes make some of that possible too. You know, the whole issue of of the particular ways in which local economies become integrated with their local hinterlands because coordination issues become easier. I think we need to stop in order for you to grade me, as it were. The other two components of this part of the lecture, I think, are they're also in the readings where I also criticize these theses, so I don't think it's so crucial for me to go through them here. Let me pass this around, and somebody who's going to be going up to sociology.
Okay.
Let me pass these around, just put them back in here, and I will see all of you Saturday morning.